Allegorical Interpretation, III. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the face of the Lord God in the midst of the tree of the garden, Gen 3:8. This introduces a doctrine that teaches that the worthless person is a fugitive. For if virtue is the native city of the wise, then whoever cannot share in it has been banished from the city the worthless person is unable to share in. The worthless person alone, then, has been banished and exiled. And the one who is a fugitive from virtue is at once hidden from God. For if the wise are visible to God, since they are his friends, it is clear that all the worthless hide and submerge themselves, as being enemies and hostile to right reason. That the worthless person is without a city and without a home is attested in the case of Esau, whose vice is shaggy and versatile, when it says, Esau was skilled in hunting, a man of the field. Gen 25:27. For the predatory vice of the passions is not suited to dwell in the city of virtue, pursuing rusticity and lack of education along with great insensibility. But Jacob, full of wisdom, is both a citizen and dwells in a house, virtue. At any rate, it says of him, but Jacob was an unfeigned man, dwelling in a house, Ibid. That is why also the midwives, because they feared God, made houses for themselves, Exod. 1:21, for those who search out the hidden mysteries of God, which is to keep the males alive, build up the works of virtue, in which they have chosen also to dwell. Through these passages, then, it has been shown how the worthless person is without city and without home, being a fugitive from virtue, while the person of worth has been allotted wisdom as both city and house to possess. Let us next see how someone is also said to hide from God. Unless one allegorizes, it is impossible to accept the passage before us, for God has filled all things and has passed through all things and has left nothing empty or void of himself. What place, then, will someone occupy in which God is not? This too is attested elsewhere, where it says, God is in heaven above and on earth below, and there is none besides him, Deut. 4:39, and again, here I stand before you, Exod. 17:6, for God exists before everything that has come into being, and he is found everywhere so that no one could possibly hide from him. And why do we marvel at this? Even the most cohesive of the things that have come into being we could not escape or hide from, even if we tried. Let someone flee earth, or water, or air, or heaven, or the whole universe. It is necessary that we be contained within these, for no one will be able to flee outside the universe. Then, if one who cannot hide from the parts of the universe, nor from the universe itself, could such a person have the power to escape God's notice? By no means. What then does they hid themselves mean? The worthless person imagines that God exists in a place, not as containing, but as being contained. And this is why he thinks he can hide, as though the cause were not present in that part where he has resolved to lurk. But it should be understood this way. In the worthless person, the true opinion about God has been overshadowed and hidden, for he is full of darkness, having no divine radiance by which he might survey the things that exist. Such a person has been banished from the divine choir, like the leper and the man with a discharge. The one bringing God and becoming, opposite natures represented by two colors, together as if they were both causes, when there is only one cause, the one who acts. The other, the man with the discharge, tracing all things from the universe and back to the universe, thinking that nothing has come to be by God, a companion of Heraclitus's opinion, introducing satiety and want, and the one is all, and all things in exchange. That is why the divine word also says, let them send out of the holy soul every leper and every man with a discharge and everyone unclean in soul, male or female, Num 5:2, and the emasculated and those cut off in the generative parts of the soul, and the fornicators who flee from the rule of the one, for these it is expressly forbidden to come into the assembly of God, Deut. 23:2. But the reasonings of the wise are not hidden, quite the contrary, they long to be visible. Do you not see that Abraham was still standing before the Lord, and drawing near he said, will you destroy the righteous with the impious? Gen 18:22-23, he who is visible and known to you, standing beside the one who flees and hides from you. For the latter is impious, but righteous is the one who stands facing you and does not flee. For it is right, Master, that you alone be honored. But just as an impious person is found, so also is a pious one found, though it is only something to be grateful for, if he is righteous, on account of which it says, Will you destroy the righteous with the impious? For no one honors God worthily, but only justly, since it is not even possible to repay parents with equal favors, for one cannot beget them in return. How is it not impossible to repay or praise as he deserves God, who established the whole of things out of what did not exist? For he supplied every virtue. Be visible to God always, then, O soul, at the three seasons, that is, throughout the whole threefold division of time, not dragging along the female perceptible passion, but offering up as incense the masculine reasoning, trained in endurance. For the sacred word commands that every male be seen before the Lord God of Israel at three seasons of the year due. 16:16. That is why Moses too, when he becomes visible to God, flees the dissolute character of Pharaoh, who boasts that he does not know the Lord. Moses withdrew, it says, from the face of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, Exod. 2:15. That is, in the judgment of the things of nature, and sat down by the well, waiting to see what good, drinkable thing God would rain down for the thirsting and longing soul. He withdraws, then, from Pharaoh, the godless opinion that rules over the passions, and he withdraws into Midian, that is, judgment, weighing whether he ought to remain quiet or again render judgment against the worthless person for his destruction. He considers whether, by attacking, he will have the strength to win the victory. This is why he is held back and waits, as I said, to see whether God will supply, for the deep and not shallow reasoning, a spring sufficient to overwhelm the onrush of the king of the Egyptians, that is, his passions. Yet he is deemed worthy of grace. For having taken up the campaign on behalf of virtue, he does not cease from warring until he sees the pleasures thrown down flat on their faces and rendered powerless. That is why Moses does not flee from Pharaoh, for then he would have run away without ever turning back. But he withdraws, that is, he makes a truce in the war, in the manner of an athlete who takes a breather and gathers his strength. Until, having roused the alliance of prudence and the rest of virtue by means of divine words, he attacks with the most vigorous force. But Jacob, for he is the supplanter, acquiring virtue by devices and skills, not without a struggle, for he had not yet been renamed Israel, flees from the affairs concerning Laban, that is, from colors and shapes and in general bodies which by nature wound the mind through the senses. For since he was unable, by staying, to defeat them completely, he flees, fearing defeat at their hands, and he is greatly worthy of praise for this. For Moses says, "You shall make the sons of the seer cautious." Lev 15:31, not bold and loving these things on their own account. And Jacob hid it from Laban the Syrian, so as not to tell him that he was fleeing. And he fled, he and all that was his, and crossed the river and set out for Mount Gilead. Gen 31:20-21. It is altogether natural to hide the fact that one is fleeing, and not to announce it to Laban, the reasoning that is tied to the objects of sense. As for instance, if you have seen some beauty and been captivated by it, and are about to stumble over it, flee unnoticed from its appearance and no longer report it to the mind, that is, do not reconsider it again or dwell on it. For repeated recollections engrave sharp impressions that damage the understanding and often overturn it against its will. The same reasoning applies to all things that draw us by way of any sense whatever. For in these cases, secret flight is what saves, while being reminded and reporting and dwelling on the memory overpowers and violently enslaves the reasoning. Never then, O understanding, if you are about to be captured by it, report to yourself the perceptible object that has appeared, nor dwell on it, so that you not be overpowered and made wretched. But, setting out unrestrained, flee, preferring an untamed freedom to a docile slavery. Why, then, does it now speak as though Jacob did not know that Laban was a Syrian, saying, "Jacob hid it from Laban the Syrian"? This, too, has a meaning that is not beside the point, for Syria is interpreted as lofty things. So the mind Jacob, the one in training, when he sees the passion lowly, waits, reckoning that he will defeat it by force. But when it is lofty and stiff-necked and swollen, then the mind in training flees first, and then all the parts of his training as well. His readings, his exercises, his practices, his remembrance of noble things, his self-control, his performance of duties, and he crosses the river of sense-perception that floods and submerges the soul with the onrush of the passions. And having crossed, he sets out for the lofty and elevated, the reasoning of perfect virtue. for he set out for Mount Gilead, which is interpreted migration of testimony. God, having made the soul migrate from the passions represented by Lee, and having testified to it that the migration is profitable and advantageous, and leading it up from the evils that render the soul lowly and groveling to the height and greatness of virtue. That is why Laban, the friend of the senses, acting according to them and not according to the mind, is indignant and pursues and says, "Why did you flee secretly?" Gen 30:1-26. Why did you not remain to enjoy the body, and the doctrine that judges both the goods within and the goods without? But even in fleeing from this opinion, you have robbed me of my very intelligence, both Lee and Rachel. For these, so long as they remained with the soul, produced good sense in it, but once they had migrated away, they left it ignorance and lack of education. That is why it adds, "You have stolen from me, Ibid." That is, you have stolen good sense. What then was this good sense? It will explain, for it adds, "And you have led away my daughters like captives, and if you had told me, I would have sent you away, Ibid." You would not have sent away things that fight against each other, for if you had truly sent the soul away and set it free, you would have stripped from it all the bodily and sense-perceptible clamor. For this is how the understanding is redeemed from vices and passions. But as it is, you say that you send it away free, while by your actions you admit that you would have detained it in prison. For if you had sent it forth, with music and tambourines and lyre, and the pleasures belonging to each sense, you would not truly have sent it away. For it is not only you, Laban, companion of bodies and colors, that we flee, but all that is yours as well, among which are also the voices of the senses that resound together with the activities of the passions. For we have practiced, if indeed we are trainees in virtue, the necessary practice that Jacob too practiced, of destroying and doing away with the gods foreign to the soul, the molten gods, which Moses has forbidden anyone to fashion, Lev. 19:4, for these are the dissolution of virtue and well-being, but the constitution and solidifying of vice and the passions, for what has been poured out, once dissolved, congeals again. It speaks thus, "And they gave Jacob the foreign gods that were in their hands, and the earrings that were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth that is in Shechem." Gen 35:4. These are the gods of the worthless. And Jacob is not said to take them, but to hide and destroy them with complete precision. For the person of true worth will take nothing for his own gain from the things that come from vice, but will hide and secretly make them disappear. Just as Abraham too, when the king of Sodom devised to make an exchange of the irrational nature for the rational, a horse for men, said he would take nothing that belonged to that man, but would stretch out his word by way of symbol, for hand, his soul's action to God Most High. Gen 14. For he would take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap from all that belonged to that man, so that he might not say he had made rich the one who beholds, giving in exchange, instead. The poverty of a rich virtue. The passions are always hidden and kept in check at Shechem, which is interpreted shoulder. For the one who labors over pleasures is one who keeps guard over pleasures, but they are destroyed and done away with in the case of the wise, not for some short time, but until this very day, that is, forever. For the whole of eternity is measured by today, since the measure of all time is the daily cycle. This is why Jacob gives Shechem to Joseph as a special portion, Gen 48:22. Shechem, the bodily and sense-perceptible things, to the one who labors over them, while to Judah, who confesses, he gives not gifts but praise and hymns and songs worthy of God from his brothers, Gen 49:8. Jacob takes Shechem not from God, but by sword and bow, Gen 48:22, by arguments that cut and defend. For the wise man subjects even the second-rank things to himself by force of reasoning. But having subdued them, he does not keep them for himself. He gives them freely to the one whose nature fits them. Do you not see that even when he seemed to be receiving the gods, he did not in fact receive them, but hid them away and made them disappear and destroyed them for all time thereafter? To whom, then, was it given to hide and make vanish vice, except to the soul to whom God has been made manifest, and whom he has judged worthy even of the unspeakable mysteries? For he says, "Shall I hide from Abraham my servant what I am doing?" Gen 18:17. Well done, Savior, that you display your own works to the soul that longs for what is good, and hide none of your works from it. Because of this, it has the strength to flee vice and to hide it and cover it in shadow and destroy forever that harmful passion. We have shown, then, in what way the base person is a fugitive and hides from God. Let us now consider where he hides. In the middle, it says, of the tree of the garden, Gen 3:8, that is, in the middle of the mind, which is itself situated in the middle, as it were the garden of the whole soul. For the one who runs away from God takes refuge in himself. For there being two minds, that of the universe, which is God, and one's own, the man who flees from his own mind takes refuge in the mind of all things. For the one who abandons his own private mind confesses that nothing belonging to the human mind truly exists, and attributes everything to God. While the one who runs away from God, conversely, says that God is the cause of nothing, but that he himself is the cause of everything that comes to be. It is said indeed by many that all things in the world move of their own accord without a guide, and that it is the human mind alone that has established arts, pursuits, laws, customs, and rules of justice, both political and private, common to men and to irrational creatures alike. But you see, O soul, how these opinions differ. The one soul, abandoning the particular, generated, and mortal, ascribes true being to the universal, ungenerated, and imperishable. The other, in turn, rejecting the God who is not even able to help himself, draws to itself the mind as an ally wrongly. This is why Moses too says, if the thief is found breaking in and is struck and dies, there is no blood guilt for him, but if the sun has risen upon him, he is guilty and shall be put to death in turn. Exod 22:1-2. For if anyone cuts through and divides the argument that stands firm, sound, and upright, the argument that testifies that God alone can do all things and is found breaking in, that is, in what is pierced through and divided, since he knows only his own mind at work and not God, he is a thief, taking for himself what belongs to another. For all things are the possessions of God, so that whoever assigns anything to himself is embezzling what belongs to another, and bears a wound most grievous and hard to heal, self-conceit, a thing akin to ignorance and lack of education. But the text leaves the one who strikes him at rest, for he is no different from the one struck. Rather, just as the one who rubs himself is himself rubbed, and the one who stretches himself is himself stretched, for he receives in himself both the power of the agent and the passion of the one who undergoes it. So too the one who steals the things of God and inscribes them to himself is tormented by his own godlessness and self-conceit. Would that, however, being struck, he might die, that is, might remain forever inactive, for then he would seem to sin less. For vice is contemplated in one aspect as a settled state, in another as a motion. And the vice that consists in motion tends toward the fulfillment and completion of its effects, and is for this reason worse than the vice that is merely a state. If then the reasoning faculty dies, the faculty that regards itself, rather than God, as the cause of what comes to be, that is, if it grows still and contracts, there is no blood guilt for it. It has not utterly destroyed the living doctrine that ascribes all powers to God. But if the sun rises, that is, if the mind that shines brightly within us rises, and seems to see through all things and adjudicate all things and think that nothing escapes it, it is guilty and shall be put to death in turn, for the living doctrine it destroyed, according to which God alone is the cause, and it will be found itself inactive and truly dead, having become the introducer of a soulless, mortal, and discordant doctrine. This is why the sacred word curses the one who sets up in secret a carved or molten image, the work of a craftsman's hands, Deut. 27:15. For why do you store up and treasure within yourself, O reasoning faculty, these base opinions, that God has qualities as the carved image has none, that he is perishable, like the molten image, when he is in fact imperishable, instead of bringing them out into the open, so that you may be taught what is needful by those who train themselves in truth. For you think yourself skilled, because you have practiced tasteless plausibilities against the truth, but you will be found unskilled, having discovered instead a grievous disease of the soul, ignorance that refuses to be healed. That the base person sinks down into his own scattered mind in fleeing from him who truly is, Moses will bear witness, Moses, who struck the Egyptian and hid him in the sand, Exod 2:12. What this meant was that he reasoned against the one who claims to be master of the body and reckons the soul its slave, and who takes pleasures to be the end of life. For having observed the toil that the king of Egypt, vice, the ruler of the passions, imposes upon the one who sees God, the mind sees the Egyptian man, the human and perishable passion, striking and abusing the one who sees. And having looked all around the whole soul, this way and that, and having seen nothing standing firm except him who truly is, but all else shaken and tossed about, it strikes down the pleasure-loving passion, and having reasoned it through, hides it in the scattered and dispersed mind, which has been deprived of kinship and union with the good. This one, then, has hidden himself away within himself. But the one opposite to him flees from himself, and takes refuge in the God of all that is. This is why it says, "He brought him outside and said, 'Look up to heaven and count the stars,'" Gen 15:5. Stars which we would wish to encompass and survey in full, being insatiable in our love of virtue, yet we are unable to measure the wealth of God. But nevertheless, thanks be to the giver of gifts, that he says he has sown in the soul such seeds, far shining and bright and wholly intellectual, like the stars in heaven. And it is not by accident that outside is added to he brought him. For who is brought out from within? But perhaps what is meant is this: he brought him out into the outermost region, not into something external that can be encompassed by others. For just as in houses the men's quarters are outside the bedchamber, but inside the courtyard, and the outer gate is outside the courtyard, but inside the entrance passage, so too in the soul it is possible for what is outside one thing to be inside another. This then is how it must be understood: he brought the mind out into. For what benefit would there be in leaving the body behind, only to take refuge in sense perception? What benefit in casting off sense perception, but shrinking back before articulate reason? For the mind that is about to be brought out and set free in liberty must escape from everything, bodily necessities, the organs of sense perception, sophistic arguments, plausibilities, and last of all, even from itself. This is why elsewhere he boasts, saying, "The Lord, God of heaven and God of earth, who took me from the house of my father," Gen 24:7. For it is not possible for one who dwells in a mortal body as such to keep company with God, but only for the one who has flowed forth out of it. For this reason too, the joy of the soul, Isaac, whenever he converses alone with God in solitude, goes out, leaving behind himself and his own mind. Isaac went out, it says, to converse alone in the field toward evening, Gen 24:63. And Moses too, the prophetic word says, "When I go out from the city, the soul, for the soul too is a city, giving laws and customs to the living creature, I will spread out my hands," Exod 9:29, "and I will open wide and lay out flat all my actions, calling God as witness and overseer of each one," God, from whom vice cannot by nature hide itself, but must be spread open and seen in plain sight. Whenever, indeed, the soul is spread open through all its words and deeds, and is made divine, the voices of the senses fall silent, along with all the troublesome and ill-named sounds. For the visible thing calls out and summons sight to itself, sound calls hearing, vapor calls smell, and in general the sense object summons sense perception to itself. But all these cease once the reasoning faculty, going out from the city of the soul, consecrates its own actions and thoughts to God. For indeed, the hands of Moses are heavy," Exod 17:12. "Since the deeds of the base person are windy and light, the deeds of the wise would be heavy, unmoving, and not easily shaken. They are steadied by Aaron, who is speech, and Hur, who is light, for nothing among these things is trivial to the truth." Through these symbols, then, it means to show you that the deeds of the wise are steadied by the most necessary things, speech and truth. This is why, when Aaron dies, that is, when he is perfected, he ascends to Hur, who is light, num. 20:25. For the end of speech is truth, which shines more brightly than light, and it is to this that speech is eager to come. Do you not see that, when he received the tent from God, Exod 33:7, that is, wisdom in which the wise man dwells and makes his home, he pitched it and made it firm and set it fast, not within the body, but outside it. For he likens the body to camp, an army camp full of wars and all the evils that war produces, having no share of peace. And it was called the tent of witness. Wisdom, witness to by God, for indeed, everyone who sought the Lord would go out, most beautifully said. For if you seek God, O reasoning faculty, go out from yourself and seek him. But if you remain within bodily masses or within the mind's own conceits, you have no part in seeking the divine, even if you pretend that you are seeking it. Whether, in seeking, you will find God is uncertain. For to many he has not made himself manifest, but their zeal has remained incomplete to the end. Yet even the bare act of seeking by itself is enough for a share in good things, for impulses toward what is good, even if they fail of their end, bring joy beforehand to those who feel them. Thus the base person, fleeing virtue and hiding from God, takes refuge in a weak helper, his own mind. But the good person, on the contrary, runs away from himself and turns back toward the knowledge of the One, winning thereby a noble race and the best contest of all. And the Lord God called to Adam and said to him, "Where are you?" Gen 3:9. Why is Adam alone called, when the woman too is hidden along with him? It must first be said that the mind is called back to where it was, whenever it receives conviction and a check upon its turning aside. And it is not only the mind itself that is called, but all its powers as well, for without its powers the mind by itself is found naked and scarcely even existing. And one of these powers is sense perception, which is the woman. The woman, sense perception, is therefore called along with Adam, the mind, but she is not called by herself. Why? Because, being irrational, she cannot receive conviction from herself, for neither sight nor hearing nor any of the other senses can be taught, so that none of them is able to grasp things by comprehension. For the one who fashioned sense perception made it capable only of distinguishing bodies, but the mind is the part that can be taught, and it is for this reason that it, but it was not perception that he summoned. Now, where are you can be understood in several ways. In one sense, it is not a question but a statement, equivalent to you are in a place. Reading, where are you with the accent thrown back? For since you suppose that God walks in the garden and is contained by it, learn that you have not thought well of this, and hear from God a most true saying, that God is not anywhere, for he is not contained, but contains the universe, whereas that which has come into being is necessarily in a place, since it must be contained and cannot contain. The second sense of what is said is equivalent to this. Where have you come to, O soul? For what goods have you chosen such evils? When God called you to share in virtue, you pursue vice instead, and though he offered for your enjoyment the tree of life, that is, the wisdom by which you might live, you have gorged yourself on ignorance and corruption, preferring the misery that is the soul's death to the happiness of true life. The third sense is a genuine question, to which two answers might be given. One, to the questioner, where are you, is nowhere, for the soul of that sort has no place on which it might set foot or on which it might be established. And for this reason, the base person is said to be out of place, for what is out of place is an evil hard to set right. Such is the person who is not of noble character, forever tossed and shaken, carried about like an unsteady wind, companion to no firm judgment whatsoever. There might be another answer of this kind, the one Adam himself uses. Here where I am, where those are who are unable to see God, where those are who do not listen to God, where those are who hide the cause, where those are who flee virtue, where those are who are naked of wisdom, where those are who fear and tremble from cowardice and faint-heartedness of soul. For when he says, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I am naked, and I hid myself, Gen 3:10, he sets forth all these confinements, as we have also shown at greater length earlier. And yet Adam is not naked now. It was said a little earlier that they made themselves loincloths. But through this too, he wishes to teach you that he does not mean the nakedness of the body, but that state in which the mind is found stripped and bare of virtue. The woman, he says, whom you gave to be with me, she gave me from the tree, and I ate, Gen 3:12. It is well said, not the woman whom you gave to me, but with me. For you did not give perception to me as a possession, but let it go free and unrestrained, in a certain way not submitting to the commands of my own understanding. At any rate, if the mind should wish to command sight not to see, sight will nonetheless see what lies before it. And hearing, when a sound falls upon it, will certainly take hold of it, even if the mind, in its stubbornness, orders it not to hear. And smell, too, will smell the vapors that reach it, even if the mind forbids it to perceive them. For this reason God did not give perception to the living being, but with the living being. And this is what it means. Perception recognizes everything together with our mind, and at the same time as it. For instance, Sight fastens on the visible object at the same moment as the mind. The eye sees the body, and at once the mind grasps what has been seen, that it is black or white or yellow or red, triangular or square or round, or has some other color or shape. Again, hearing is struck by a sound, and the mind along with it, and the proof is that it judges the sound at once, whether it is faint or has volume, whether it is melodious and well-measured, or again whether it is discordant and unharmonious. And the same thing is found in the case of the other senses as well. It is very finely put, too, that he adds, "She gave me from the tree," for no one gives the mind the wooden and perceptible mass except perception. For who gave the understanding the means to recognize the body or its whiteness? Was it not sight? And who gave it the sound? Was it not hearing? And who the vapor? Was it not smell? And who the flavor? Was it not taste? And who the rough and the soft? Was it not touch? Rightly, then, and very truly has it been said by the mind, "That perception alone gives me the apprehensions of bodies." And God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" And the serpent deceived me, and I ate. Gen 3:13. God inquires about one thing from perception, but she answers about another. For he inquires about something concerning the man, while she speaks not about him but about herself, saying, "I ate, not I gave." Perhaps, then, by reading allegorically, we shall resolve the difficulty and show that the woman answers the question directly. For it is necessary that, once she has eaten, the man too should eat. For whenever perception, fastening upon the perceptible object, is filled with the impression of it, at once the mind too has grasped it, taken hold of it, and in a certain way been filled with nourishment from it. This, then, is what she means: "I gave to the man unknowingly. For when I laid hold of the object before me, he, being quick to move, received the impression and was imprinted by it." Observe that the man says the woman gave, while the woman says not that the serpent gave, but that it deceived. For it is proper to perception to give, but to pleasure, the manifold and serpentine kind, to deceive and lead astray. For instance, nature's white and black, hot and cold, are given by perception to the mind, not by way of deception, but truthfully. For the underlying things are such as the impression that strikes from them also is, according to most of those who study nature, without proper insight. But pleasure does not present the underlying thing to the understanding as it actually is. Rather, it falsifies it by artifice, bringing what is harmful into the rank of the beneficial. Just as one can see hideous courtesans painting themselves and lining their eyes, so as to conceal the ugliness about them, so too the man without self-control, bent toward the pleasure of the belly. He welcomes strong wine in quantity and lavish preparation of food as a good, while being harmed in both body and soul by them. Again, one can often see lovers utterly infatuated with the ugliest of women, pleasure deceiving them and all but proclaiming that beauty of form, fine complexion, good flesh, and proportion of parts belong to women who possess exactly the opposite of these. At any rate, they overlook women who possess a beauty genuinely beyond reproach, and melt with longing for those I have described. All deception, then, belongs most properly to pleasure, and all giving to perception. For pleasure devises and leads the mind astray, showing not what the underlying things actually are but what they are not, whereas perception gives bodies purely as they are by nature, without fabrication or artifice. And the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all the cattle and above all the wild beasts of the earth. On your breast and belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall watch your head, and you shall watch his heel." Gen 3:14-15. For what reason does he curse the serpent without a defense, though elsewhere he bids it as fitting that the two between whom there is a dispute should stand? Deut. 19:17, and that one should not simply believe one party in advance. And indeed you see that in the case of Adam he did not believe in advance against the woman, but gave her an opportunity for defense when he asked, "What is this you have done?" Gen 3:13. And she confesses her fault, laid low by the deception of the serpentine and manifold pleasure. What then prevented him, once the woman had said, "The serpent deceived me," from questioning the serpent as to whether it had indeed deceived her, rather than cursing it without judgment and without a defense? We must say, then, that perception belongs neither to the base nor to the excellent, but is something intermediate and common to both the wise and the foolish. and coming to be in a fool it becomes base, but in a person of good character it becomes excellent. Reasonably so, since it does not have a wicked nature of its own, but being poised between the two, inclines toward either the better or the worse. And so it is not condemned before it has confessed that it has followed the worse. But the serpent, pleasure, is wicked in itself. For this reason, it is not found at all in the person of good character, and only the base person enjoys it. In keeping with what is proper to it, then, God curses it without granting it a defense, since it has no seed of virtue, but is always and everywhere culpable and defiled. For this reason too, God, without any evident cause, knows her to be wicked, Gen 38:7, and puts him to death. For he is not ignorant that our body, this leathern mass, for is translated leathern, is wicked and a plotter against the soul, and dead and always in a state of death. For you must think of each of us as doing nothing other than carrying a corpse, the soul raising the dead body from within itself and bearing it without weariness. Consider, if you will, the soul's own vigor. The most powerful athlete would not have the strength to carry even a statue of himself for a short time, yet the soul, sometimes for as much as 100 years, carries the statue that is a human being lightly and without growing weary. For it is not now that it kills the body, but from the beginning it made the body a corpse. It is wicked by nature, then, as I have said, and a plotter against the soul, but it does not appear so to everyone, only to God, and to whoever is a friend of God. For it says, was wicked before the Lord. For whenever the mind soars aloft and is initiated into the mysteries of the Lord, it judges the body wicked and hostile. But whenever it withdraws from the search for divine things, it regards the body as a friend, kin, and brother to itself, and takes refuge, in fact, in the things that are dear to it. For this reason, the soul of the athlete differs from that of the philosopher. The athlete refers everything to the good condition of the body, and being a lover of the body would give up the soul itself on its behalf. But the philosopher, being a lover of the beauty that lives within himself, cares for the soul and disregards the truly dead body, aiming only that it should not be discordant, bound to an evil and dead companion, and so mar the soul, which is the best part of us. You see that it is not the Lord who kills but God. For it is not insofar as he rules and governs, exercising the authority of sovereign power, that he destroys the body, but insofar as he exercises goodness and kindness. For God is the name of the cause in its goodness, so that you may know that even lifeless things he has made not by sheer authority, but by goodness, just as he made living things also. For it was necessary, for the demonstration of the better things, that the coming into being of the worse things too should be brought about by the power of that same goodness of the cause, which is God. When then, O soul, will you suppose yourself to be carrying a corpse in the fullest sense? Is it not when you have been made perfect and judged worthy of prizes and crowns? For then you will be a lover of God, not a lover of the body, and you will attain the prizes if the bride of Judah, Tamar, becomes your wife, she whose name is translated palm tree, a symbol of victory. And here is the proof. When took her, he was at once found to be wicked and was put to death. For it says, Judah took a wife for his firstborn, whose name was Tamar, Gen 38:6, and immediately adds, and was wicked before the Lord, and God killed him, Ibid. 7. For whenever the mind has carried off the prizes of victory, it condemns the dead body to death. You see that he curses the serpent too without a defense, for it is pleasure. And he kills without any evident cause, for it is body. And if you consider it, noble friend, you will find that God has made natures that are in themselves culpable and blameworthy in the soul, and others in all respects excellent and praiseworthy, just as is also the case among plants and animals. Don't you see that the craftsman made some plants tame, beneficial, and life-preserving, but others wild, harmful, and the cause of disease and destruction, and animals in the same way? Take the serpent, for instance, which is now our subject. It is by its very nature a destructive and death-dealing creature. What the serpent does to a man, pleasure does to the soul, and that is why the serpent has been made a likeness of pleasure. Just as God has hated pleasure and the body without stating his reasons, so too he has advanced certain refined natures without any evident cause, acknowledging no prior deed of theirs as grounds for the praise. For if someone should ask why he says that Noah found favor before the Lord God, Gen 6:8, even though, as far as we can tell, Noah had done nothing distinguished beforehand, we will answer rightly, that this attests the excellence of his constitution and origin. Noah is interpreted as rest or just, and one who has ceased from wrongdoing and sin, resting in what is good and living together with justice, must necessarily find favor with God. To find favor is not, as some suppose, simply equivalent to be well-pleasing. It is something more. The just man, in searching out the nature of things, discovers this as the single best discovery, that the universe in its entirety is a favor of God, and that no part of coming into being is a gift bestowed on its own account, since it is not even a possession in its own right, but everything belongs to God as his possession. That is why favor belongs to him alone. So to those who ask what is the source of coming into being, the most correct answer would be the goodness and favor of God, which he bestowed on the race that came after him. For everything in the cosmos and the cosmos itself is a gift, a benefaction, and a favor of God. And God made Melchizedek, king of peace, for that is what Salem means, his own priest, Gen 14:18, without having outlined beforehand any deed of his, but rather having made him such a king from the start, a lover of peace and worthy of his own priesthood. For he is called a just king, and a king is the enemy of a tyrant, since the one is a champion of laws, the other of lawlessness. The tyrant mind, then, issues commands to soul and body that are violent, harmful, and productive of intense pains. I mean the deeds done in accordance with vice and the enjoyments of the passions. The king, by contrast, does not so much command as persuade, and the commands he gives are of a kind that let the living creature, like a ship, enjoy fair sailing through life, steered by the good pilot and craftsman, who is right reason. Let the tyrant, then, be called the leader of war, and the king the leader of peace, Salem, and let him bring to the soul food full of gladness and joy. For he brings bread and wine, which the Ammonites and the Moabites refuse to offer to the one who sees, for which reason they are barred from the assembly and the divine congregation. For the Ammonites are those born of sense perception, our mother, and the Moabites those born of mind, our father, two characters who suppose that mind and sense perception are what hold reality together, without grasping any conception of God. They shall not enter, says Moses, into the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet us with bread and water, Deut. 23:3-4, as we came out from the passions of Egypt. But let Melchizedek offer wine instead of water, and give the souls to drink, and make them drunk, that they may be possessed by a divine intoxication more sober than sobriety itself. For he is a priest, the Logos, who has being as his portion, and who reasons about him in lofty, exalted, and magnificent terms. For he is priest of the Most High, Gen 14:18. Not that there is some other God who is not Most High, for God, being one, is above in heaven and below on earth, and there is none besides him, Deut. 4:39, but rather because to think of God not in a lowly and groveling way, but in terms immeasurably great, immaterial, and lofty, evokes the sense of Most High. What good deed, then, had Abram already accomplished, that God commands him to leave his homeland and this kindred, and to dwell in a land that God himself will give him, Gen 12:1? It is a good city, great and altogether blessed, for the gifts of God are great and precious, and by this method too God has begotten a pattern worthy of study. For Abram is interpreted as exalted father, and by both names he is praiseworthy. For the mind, whenever it does not command the soul in the manner of a despot, but rules as a father, not granting it what is pleasant, but bestowing what is beneficial even against its will, and altogether withdraws from lowly things that lead toward the mortal, and roams the heights instead, spending its time on contemplations concerning the cosmos and its parts, and rising even further, searches out the divine and its nature through an unspeakable love of knowledge. Then it cannot remain fixed on its original opinions, but seeks migration, always bettering itself toward what is better. Some, moreover, God shapes and disposes well even before their birth, and has chosen for them the best portion in advance. Don't you see what he says to Abraham about Isaac? When Abraham had not hoped that he would become the father of such offspring, but had even laughed at the promise and said, "Shall a child be born to one who is 100 years old, and shall Sarah, who is 90, bear a child?" Gen 17:17. God affirms in a sense, saying, "Yes, behold, Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant." Ib. 19. What then is it that made this child, too, be praised before his birth? Some good things benefit us once they have come to be and are present: health, for instance, keenness of perception; wealth, should it come our way; reputation, though these are called goods only in a loose sense. But others benefit us not only once they have come to be, but even when merely foretold that they will come to be, as with joy, which is a good disposition of the soul. For joy delights us not only when it is present and actively at work, but even when it is merely hoped for, it gladdens us in advance. And this too is a distinctive feature it has. Other goods each operate in their own private sphere, but joy is both a private and a common good. For it comes upon everything. We rejoice at health, at freedom, at honor, and at all the rest, so that, properly speaking, nothing can be called good if joy is not attached to it. But we do not rejoice only over other goods that have already come to be and are present. We rejoice also over things that are yet to come and are anticipated. As when we hope to grow wealthy, or to hold office, or to be praised, or to find release from sickness, or to share in vigor and strength, or to become knowledgeable in place of ignorant, we are glad beyond measure. Since then joy, whether present or merely hoped for, floods and gladdens the soul, it was fitting that God should deem Isaac worthy of a name and a great gift even before his birth. For laughter of the soul, joy and gladness is what this name means. Again, of Jacob and Esau, while they were still in the womb, God declares that the one will be ruler, leader, and master, and the other, Esau, subject and slave. For God, the molder of living things, knows well his own creations even before he has fully chiseled them into shape, the powers they will later exercise, and, in short, their deeds and passions. For when the soul of patient endurance, Rebekah, went to inquire of God, he answered her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the greater shall serve the lesser." Gen 25:23. For in God's sight what is base and irrational is by nature a slave, while what is refined, rational, and better is fit to lead and is free. And this holds not only once each has come to full completion in the soul, but even while it is still uncertain. For in general, even the slightest breath of virtue reveals the beginning of leadership, not merely of freedom, and conversely, the mere onset of vice enslaves the reasoning power, even before its offspring has fully emerged. And what did this same Jacob do when Joseph brought forward his two sons, the elder Manasseh and the younger Ephraim? He crossed his hands and laid his right hand on the younger, Ephraim, and his left on the elder Manasseh. And when Joseph took this as a serious matter and thought his father had unwittingly erred in the placing of his hands, Jacob said, "I did not err, but I know, child, I know, this one too shall become a people, and this one too shall be exalted, but his younger brother shall be greater than he." Gen 48:19. What then must we say except this, that two natures, utterly necessary, were fashioned by God and the soul, memory and recollection? Memory is the better, recollection the inferior. For memory holds its perceptions fresh and vivid, so that it cannot even go astray through ignorance, whereas recollection is invariably preceded by forgetfulness, a maimed and blind condition. Recollection, the inferior faculty, turns out to be older than memory, the better one, continuous and unbroken. For those who are first introduced to the arts are at once unable to master the theorems belonging to them. So, being at first subject to forgetting, we recollect again and again, until, through much forgetting and much recollecting, memory becomes at last secure and prevails. Which is why recollection, though later born, is in fact the younger sibling of memory. Symbolically, then, Ephraim is called memory, for the name is interpreted as fruitfulness, since the soul that loves learning has brought forth its own proper fruit whenever it has memory to make its perceptions secure. Manasseh, by contrast, is recollection, for by translation he is said to be out of forgetfulness, and one who escapes forgetfulness must always be recollecting. Most fittingly, then, Jacob, the supplanter of the passions and practitioner of virtue, favors with his right hand Ephraim, fruit-bearing memory, and grants second place to Manasseh, recollection. Moses, too, of those who sacrifice the Passover, praises most highly those who sacrifice it the first time, because they persisted in the crossing away from the passions of Egypt and did not rush back toward them again. But those who sacrifice it the second time he judges worthy only of second place. Num. 9:6ff. Since, having turned aside, they ran back into their turning, and, as if forgetting what needed to be done, rushed again to do it, whereas the former group remained unturning to the end. It seems, then, that Manasseh, out of forgetfulness, resembles those who sacrifice the Passover the second time, while fruit-bearing Ephraim resembles those who sacrifice it the first time. This is why God calls Bezalel by name and says he will grant him wisdom and knowledge, and will show him to be the craftsman and master builder of all the works of the tabernacle, that is, of the works of the soul, Exod. 31:2ff. Without having shown beforehand any deed of his that one might praise. We must say, then, that God has stamped this pattern too upon the soul, the way one stamps a genuine coin. What, then, is this character? We shall know if we first work out precisely the meaning of the name. Bezalel, then, is interpreted in the shadow of God, and the shadow of God is his logos, which he used as an instrument when he was making the cosmos. And this shadow, this image as it were, is itself the archetype of other things. For just as God is the model for the image, which he has here called a shadow, so the image becomes the model for other things, as Moses showed at the very beginning of the lawgiving when he said, "And God made man according to the image of God." Gen 1:27, meaning that the image was modeled after God, while man received the power of a model by taking on the image. Let us then consider what character results. The first inquirers asked how we come to conceive of the divine, and those who seem to philosophize best said that we form our apprehension of the cause from the cosmos and its parts, and the powers residing within them. For just as, if someone were to see a house carefully built with gatehouses, colonnades, men's quarters, women's quarters, and other structures, he would form a notion of the craftsman. For he would not suppose the house had been completed without art and a craftsman. And in the same way with a city, a temple, and every construction, smaller or greater, so too, when someone enters, as it were, this vast house or city that is the cosmos, and observes the heaven revolving in a circle and encompassing everything within it, the planets and fixed stars moving in the same unchanging and harmonious way, beneficial to the whole, and the earth allotted the middle region, with masses of water and air arranged in between, and further, living creatures both mortal and immortal, and varieties of plants and fruits, he will reckon, surely, that these things have not come to be without complete artistry, but that the craftsman of this universe both was and is God. Those who reason in this way apprehend God through a shadow, coming to understand the craftsman through his works. But there is a more perfect and more purified mind, initiated into the great mysteries, who does not come to know the cause from the things that have come to be, as one would infer a permanent object from its shadow, but who rises above the created realm and receives a clear impression of the uncreated, so as to apprehend him from himself and his shadow along with him, which was the Logos and this cosmos. This is Moses, who says, "Show yourself to me, that I may know you clearly," Exod 33:13. That is, do not show yourself to me through heaven or earth or air or anything at all that belongs to the realm of becoming, and let me not glimpse your form mirrored in anything else, but only in you, God yourself. For the reflections found in things that have come to be dissolve, while those found in the unbegotten remain fixed, secure, and everlasting. It is for this reason that God has called Moses apart and spoken with him. God has also called Bezalel, but not in the same way. The one receives the impression of God directly from the cause itself, while the other, like someone reasoning from a shadow, comes to understand the craftsman only by inference from the things that have come to be. This is why you will find that the tabernacle and all its furnishings are constructed first by Moses and afterward by Bezalel. Moses fashions the archetypes, Bezalel fashions their copies. Moses works under God's own direction, as it says, "According to the pattern shown to you on the mountain, so shall you make everything," Exod 25:40. Bezalel works under Moses' direction, and rightly so. For indeed, when Aaron reason and Miriam's sense perception rose up against him, they are told plainly, "If there is a prophet of the Lord, he will be made known to him in a vision." and God will appear to him in shadow, not clearly. But to Moses, who is faithful in all his house, God will speak mouth to mouth, in visible form and not through riddles. Num 12:6-8. Since then we have found two natures that have come to be, shaped and finely wrought by God, the one harmful in itself, culpable and accursed, the other beneficial and praiseworthy, the one bearing a counterfeit stamp, the other a genuine one. Let us pray the fitting and fine prayer that Moses himself prayed, that God may open for us his own treasury due. 28:12. The lofty reason, pregnant with divine lights, which he has called heaven and seal, shut the treasuries of evils. For with God there are treasuries of evils just as there are of good things, as he says in the great song, are not these things stored up with me and sealed among my treasuries for the day of vengeance when their foot shall slip? Deut. 32:34-35. You see then that there are treasuries of evils, and the treasury of good things is one. Since God is one, the treasury of good things is also one, but the treasuries of evils are many, since evils too are unlimited in number. But observe the goodness of the one who is even in this. He opens the treasury of good things, but seals shut the treasuries of evils. For it belongs to God's nature to offer good things freely and even to anticipate the giving of them, but not readily to bring on evils. Moses, intensifying still further this generosity and graciousness of God, says not merely that the treasuries of evils are sealed for the ordinary run of time, but even when the soul stumbles from the footing of right reason, at the very moment when it would deserve to be brought to justice. For he says, it is on the day of vengeance that the treasuries of evils are sealed the sacred word, thereby showing that God does not proceed at once against those who sin, but grants time for repentance, for the healing of the fault, and for its correction. And the Lord God said to the serpent, cursed are you above all cattle and above all wild beasts of the earth. Gen 3:14. Just as joy, being a good state of feeling, is worthy of prayer, so pleasure the passion deserves a curse, since it shifts the boundaries of the soul and remakes it, turning it from a lover of virtue into a lover of passion. Moses says among the curses that the one who moves the boundary markers of his neighbor is accursed. Deut. 27:17. For God set virtue as a boundary marker and law for the soul, the tree of life, but the one who shifts it fixes in its place another boundary marker, vice, which is the boundary of death. Cursed too is the one who leads the blind astray on the road, Deut. 27:18, and the one who strikes his neighbor in secret, Ib. 24. These two are the work of that most godless thing, pleasure. For sense perception is blind by nature, being irrational, since it is reason that gives sight. By reason alone do we truly grasp things, no longer by sense perception, for through sense perception we form images only of bodies. It has deceived maimed sense perception in its grasp of things, since, though able to turn toward mind and be guided by it, pleasure has prevented this, leading it instead toward the external object of sense and making it greedy for the very thing that ought to have been its own product. So that sense perception, being maimed, follows the blind object of sense as its guide, while the mind, guided by two things that cannot see, is thrown headlong and loses mastery of itself. For if there were any natural order to be followed, the maimed part ought to follow the seeing reason, since that would lighten the harm done. But as it is, pleasure has set up so great a contrivance against the soul that it has forced it to use blind guides, deceiving and persuading it to exchange virtue for evils and to give up innocence in return for wickedness. The sacred word forbids just such an exchange when it says, you shall not exchange the good for the bad. Lev. 27:33. For these reasons, then, pleasure is accursed. Let us see how fitting are the things it is cursed for. It is said to be cursed above all cattle, Gen 3:14. Now the irrational and sentient is cattle-like, and each sense perception curses pleasure as its bitterest and most hostile enemy, and indeed it truly is hostile to sense perception. The proof, whenever we have been glutted with immoderate pleasure, we can no longer see, hear, smell, taste, or touch with clear perception, but our contact with these objects becomes dim and feeble. So much for that point. Whenever we restrain the use of a sense, we suffer for it. But when we are wholly given over to the enjoyments of pleasure, we lose the capacity to perceive through the cooperating senses, so that we seem to have been maimed. How then would it not be fitting for sense perception to lay curses on the pleasure that maims it? Pleasure is cursed too above all the wild beasts, I mean the passions of the soul, for by these the mind is wounded and destroyed. Why, then, does pleasure seem worse than the other passions? Because it lies beneath nearly all of them, like a foundation and starting point. For desire arises from longing for pleasure, grief arises from the loss of it, and fear in turn is born from apprehension of its absence. So it is clear that all the passions are launched from pleasure, and probably none of them could ever have come into being at all if the capacity to bear them, pleasure, had not first been laid down. On your breast and belly you shall go, Gen 3, 14. For it is around these parts, the breast and the belly, that passion lurks, around the belly and what follows it, when pleasure has the means and materials to hand, around the breast, where anger dwells when pleasure is lacking. For lovers of pleasure, when deprived of their pleasures, grow angry and embittered. Let us look still more precisely at what is being shown here. Our soul, it turns out, is threefold. One part is the rational, a second the spirited, and a third the desiring. Now some philosophers have distinguished these parts from one another only in power, others by location as well. And they have assigned to the rational part the region around the head, saying that where the king is, there too are his bodyguards, and the bodyguards are the senses of the mind, stationed around the head, so that the king too would be there, having settled, as it were, on the citadel of a city. To the spirited part they assign the breast, which is why nature has fortified this part with the density and strength of closely packed bones, arming it like a good soldier with breastplate and shield for defense against opponents. To the desiring part, they assign the region of the lower belly and stomach, for their desire dwells irrational appetite. If then you ever ask, my mind, what region has been allotted to pleasure, do not look for it in the region around the head, where the rational part is. You will not find it there, since reason is at war with passion and the two cannot remain in the same place. When reason prevails, pleasure vanishes, and when pleasure conquers, reason flees. Look instead in the breast and belly, where anger and desire are, the parts of the irrational, for it is there that our judgment and our passions are both to be found. Nothing, then, prevents the mind, once it has stepped outside the objects of thought and its own proper concerns, from being handed over to the worst part. And this happens whenever war gets the upper hand within the soul, for the reasoning within us, if it is not warlike but peaceable, is bound to be taken captive. The sacred word, knowing full well how powerful is the impulse of each of these two passions, anger and desire, curbs each of them, setting reason over them as charioteer and helmsman. And first, concerning anger, treating and healing it, it speaks as follows. And you shall put upon the oracle of judgments the manifestation and the truth, and it shall be on the breast of Aaron whenever he goes into the sanctuary before the Lord, Exod. 28:26. The oracle, then, is within us the organ of speech, which is uttered reason, and this is either ill-considered and unapproved, or well-judged and approved. It leads us to conceive of reason as a thing of discrimination. For it says the oracle is not the undiscriminating or counterfeit kind, but the kind that belongs to judgments equivalent, that is, to the discriminated and tested. Of this approved reason, he says there are two supreme virtues, clarity and truthfulness, and quite rightly. For reason's first task is to make things clear and evident to one's neighbor, since we are unable to display to others, or set before them as it truly is, the passion that has arisen within the soul. Hence we have been forced to resort to the symbols conveyed by voice, nouns, and verbs, which must be entirely familiar to all, so that our neighbor may grasp our meaning clearly and plainly. Its second task is to report these things truthfully. For what good is it to make an interpretation vivid and clear, but false? In that case the hearer is bound to be deceived, and to reap the greatest misfortune ignorance compounded with lack of instruction. What use is it, for instance, if I tell a child, showing him vividly and clearly, that the letter alpha is gamma, or that eta is omega? Or if a music teacher tells a beginner that the enharmonic genus is the chromatic, or the chromatic the diatonic, or that the hypate is the mes, or the conjunct tetrachord the disjunct, or the hyperbolean the proslambanamenos? He will perhaps speak vividly and clearly, but not truthfully, and in this way he will produce a defect in his account. But whenever he achieves both clarity and truthfulness together, he will make his account useful to the learner, employing its two virtues, which together are almost the only virtues it happens to have. He says, then, that the well-judged reason, possessing its own proper virtues, is stationed on the breast, clearly meaning Aaron's breast. That is, on anger, so that anger may first be guided by reason and not be harmed by its own irrationality, and then by clarity, for anger is not by nature a friend of clarity. In those who are angry, not only the thought, but even the words are full of confusion and disorder.